Hey, what? You're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
TV is awesome! TV is awesome! TV is awesome!
Now, here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of TV Good Sleep Bad. Joining me in the basement, as always, is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hello.
If this is your first time listening to the show, this is the podcast where myself and Lackey justify all those hours of misspent TV viewing by rewatching classic, cult, and obscure TV shows. And occasionally we get someone down here in the basement to subject them to the joys of these shows as well. And today we're joined by someone very special to the LAM, the Large Association Movie Blogs, and someone, if I was to list my saints of blogging and podcasting, he would be considered really the saint of podcasting, because through the LAMcast he has really provided this platform which in turn has inspired so many people to go off and form their own podcasts, and he's really been the guy who's given them their first break through the LAMcast. So of course it gives me the absolute pleasure to welcome to the basement today Mr. Jake Lewitt.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored. I feel like I cannot live up to that introduction, and some credit at least must be given to Dylan for starting the LAMcast and starting the LAM, but I'll take any credit given for continuing on.
I love
as his replacement.
I was like going through the other day and just like the listing off the people who did their first podcast through the LAMcast.
Yeah.
And then went off and did their own show.
It's tradition. People come as a guest on the LAMcast, start their own podcast, and then never come back.
Yeah. I mean, I started my first podcast on the LAMcast. Don't know which episode number it was, but we were talking about Ghost World. And afterwards, you sent me a really nice note saying you did a good job. And I felt, you know what? That was pretty good. And since then, it's been sort of this addiction that's carried on. I mean, Lackey, were you also a LAMcast starter?
It's sort of interesting because I think I recorded my first episode of the LAMcast. I think I recorded it the same weekend as I recorded the first episode of the Force Viewing podcast. I think we did the recordings the same weekend.
Your first podcast, your first LAMcast, Lackey, was The Shining.
Right.
Way back in February of 2012,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember. God, what movies did we discuss that month on our podcast? I want to say we might have done Tech the Killer Tomatoes that month or a couple like that, you know. But yeah, that was actually, it was so long ago. I don't even think you'd taken over hosting by then. I think Dylan was.
I had not. That was sometime before I took over. I think I took over in January 2014. So, yeah.
I mean, obviously now you are the shepherd of the LAM.
Yes, yes I am.
Wonderful platform for bloggers. And I mean, for those not familiar with what the LAM is, do you want to obviously explain what it is for our listeners?
Yes, it's a massive hole I throw all my time into. What the LAM is it's a online community of movie bloggers. It is the Large Association of Movie Blogs, the LAM. Essentially, if you write a movie blog then and have been doing so for at least 3 months, then you can be a LAM member. You can sign up. You get yourself your own little number. We're up to 1,824 members as of this morning. We have a podcast. We have several podcasts. Vern hosts Film Pasture, which is the other podcast. It's a great place to meet other bloggers, to find other blogs to read, as well as try and entice other people to come and read your own blog. You can just chat about films in general. We've got a pretty active forum going on. We collect up all the reviews of new releases every week, so you can kind of gauge an opinion of what's good in the cinema. You know, we try and cover all the bases of film blogging, basically. And if there's anything that you think we should do but we don't, then by all means let me know and I'll try and get it in there somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just the fact that you obviously the shepherd for this massive network and the fact that you're essentially keeping it all together. You're sort of like the captain of this madhouse that we've sort of assembled, and somehow you managed to keep it all together, let alone the fact that you put out a weekly show. I mean, it's, as we were saying before we came on, it's bad enough us trying to put together a monthly show, so I don't know how you managed to do a weekly show.
I've had a dickens of a time holding together a, you know, a blog of written content for the last couple months. I mean, but yeah, actually, when Elwood was talking about how you were a saint of blogging, I thought it would have been, and podcasting, I thought it would have been not just for, you know, holding, you know, hosting the Lambcast, but also putting up with the various disparate personalities, including our own.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. It's genuinely recording the podcast every Sunday is pretty much the highlight of my week. That's why I'm okay doing it. I really do enjoy it, and I wanted to. That's why I took over the lamb shepherding title, because I just wanted it to keep going. You know, I think it's a valuable community to be out there, and I want it to stay. Yep. So, yeah.
I mean,
and the trick is to let your own blog die.
Yeah.
Because my own site, Life vs. Film, not a lot happens over there anymore. I'm still struggling my way through the 1,000 movies you must see before you die list, but I'm covering far fewer than I'd really like to be.
I mean, as I said, I mean, your own site, as you said, Life vs. Film, you cover it. It's like an eclectic mixture. I mean, while it's obviously the 1001 film list that you're working your way through, you're still managing to put out there this wide variety of films. I mean, obviously, one week you do something classic, and a week you can be like looking at a kung fu movie. I was going through like your list, and I think one week you were doing like Come Drink With Me, and then the next you were like looking at some Andy Warhol movie, and it was like there's such variety, and I don't, for someone who obviously works in genres on my own blog, I don't know how you can obviously shift so effortlessly from one genre to the other. I need normally this sort of like go have these movies sort of plotted out so I can ease myself into the next genre. I kind of just like jump from one genre to the next.
How jarring they are kind of flows into my review sometimes, because I'm often, because I'm working my way through a list, I'm often really not in the mood for the film I'm watching at that point. So my reviews tend to be more negative than positive, because I'm watching them out of a sense of requirement than actually planning to enjoy the film. Sometimes I wonder why I'm watching these films. For example, I watched a film recently, Novecento, 1900, which is 5.5 hours long. It's an Italian film. I think it's Bernardo Bertolucci. I could be wrong. That was a slog to get through. That's on two Blu-ray discs. When something overflows a Blu-ray, that's when you know this is not worth your time. And yeah, about 35 to 40 minutes into that one, I was thinking, this is going to be a really long day watching this film. And by the time Donald Sutherland headbutted a cat to death, which is something that happens in that film, I began to wonder just what I'd gotten myself into with this viewing experience.
Yeah. I have to obviously ask you, you mentioned there that it's on two Blu-ray discs. Back in the olden days of DVDs, it used to be the case that you'd get half the movie on one side of the disc, you'd have to then stop, flip it over, and put the other side in. For myself, this is detaching from the movie. I need it all in one viewing. I can't be doing with this two-disc nonsense.
Yeah.
I've gone too far. This is no longer the early 90s where I'm in the Amiga and I can accept it's in there with my Amiga, and I can accept the fact I have to put in five different discs before it lets me play one match of Street Fighter. Times have obviously come far enough for us to get it all on one disc, I would hope. Is this just my own personal gripe, or does anyone else have an issue with switching discs over partway through a movie?
Oh, no, I still need to update my copy of Goodfellas because I've got the flip over one. And it's still, that's why I don't watch it more often, because I know that halfway through that film I'm going to have to get up and flip it over and then sit back down. It's just not worth it. No, it's a good film, but Jurassic Park's all on one disc, so I'll stick with that one.
Yeah. I don't even think I own a multi-disc movie. I don't actually own all that much on DVD. The discs I do tend to buy, and even I don't even buy those as much anymore with the Doctor Who releases. And there are a couple, like, you know, 7-parters or 8-parters that go on two discs. And,
yeah,
you know, at about those aren't meant to be sat down and watched entirely in one sitting anyway. So I don't really mind getting up and, you know, putting on parts 5 through 8 of whatever the 8-parter was. But yeah, I don't think I ever actually owned a film that's across 2 discs or across a DVD disc side.
Yeah. I envy you.
I only found out today that the first film ever put onto DVD was Twister.
Yes, Twister. I love that bit of trivia. Yeah.
For years, I thought it was The World Is Not Enough or Deep Blue Sea. I thought that one of those two was the first ever DVD, but it's actually Twister.
Yep. And
I don't think I knew that, yeah. But that's about right. Yeah.
I've had that as a question on Lampity before. And no one got it right.
I mean, obviously this week on the show, we've got kind of a Doctor Who theme, I want to say, happening, as we're going to be looking at the mid-90s BBC Kids TV series The Dark Season, which would be written by a future Doctor Who scribe, who I know Mr. Lackey's certainly a fan of.
Russell T. Davis.
Obviously, for yourself, Lackey, you brought, you gave us a story, shall I say, or assignment?
They don't, I guess, have official... It's like an old-school Doctor Who serial. They don't have official titles, my understanding. Generally, it's referred to either as Adventure Number 4 or Assignment Number 4. But Sapphire and Steel, a 4-part story, unofficially entitled The Man Without a Face.
So, it was... While going into this, I wasn't aware that there was this theme was so present. Obviously, when we get into these episodes, we'll be able to cover it more. But one of the key reasons for choosing The Dark Season, and certainly for inviting Joan, was the fact that it stars a young Kate Winslet. Now, for anyone who's listened to any of Jay's shows, they will know that Mr. Cluett has something of a little bit of an obsession with Mr. Winslet. What is your obsession with Kate Winslet?
Okay, I feel this may have been overstated slightly. And this is kind of an accidental obsession with Kate Winslet. Right, on my site, I do the 1001 Movies list, but I also do various kind of filmmaker missions where I'm trying to watch everything from certain filmmakers. And when I stuck, because I didn't want to just watch the 1001 movies all the time, because a lot of them are really dreary. And a lot of the films I have to watch, I watch with my partner, and I wanted to make sure there were more films on that I was watching that she could watch with me. So I picked like the films of the Coen brothers and the films of Alfred Hitchcock and Steve McQueen, because I thought there might be some more in there that she'd be interested in. And I let her pick somebody. I said, Aisha, you can pick anyone you like within reason, and we'll watch all of their films. But the trick is that she had to be there with me to watch them, so she couldn't go and pick someone that I would hate to watch the films just to punish me for some reason. And she picked Kate Winslet. And I was fine with this because a lot of Kate Winslet's films I have to review somewhere else. The ones I hadn't seen, for the most part, I was interested in. So, yeah, I've now since gone through and watched almost all of Kate Winslet's films. The only ones I haven't reviewed yet are Little Children and some of the ones she did this year and last year. So The Dressmaker, Steve Jobs, and 999.
Okay.
So, which I've seen all of those apart from 999. I just haven't written the review yet. And there's a film called Plunge, the movie from 2003, which I cannot find anywhere. I'm just going to give up on. I don't think it exists. I don't think it was ever released. It's just it's on IMDb, but it's nowhere to be found. So if anybody out there knows where to find Plunge, the movie from 2003 featuring Kate Winslet, please let me know. It's on the case.
Becky is on the case. Except I call it Purge. I call it Plunge, the movie. So... things I'm looking for. Oh, there's much. Although it looks, things I'm. Google seems to think that I'm looking for the Purge election year.
No, which, no, fortunately she's not in that, so I haven't got to watch that.
No, but yet we watch movie 23
or 43. Yes, there have been some. When this list began, it was before it was announced that she would be in movie 43, and before it was announced that she would be in Labor Day. And the Divergent series, and A Little Chaos, and Insurgent, and The Dressmaker, and all of these terrible films. She's got a run of like 6 films in a row that are just abysmal.
Yeah.
And they've all been since I've announced I was doing this. So it's like she heard, and I thought, well, I'm going to punish him then.
I think when I started watching Kate Winslet movies, because it was after Titanic came out, and It seemed that every move I hit, it was Kate Winslet that was nude. And I was like, wow, does this girl ever keep her clothes on? Because it was sort of like, I watched Titanic, so nudity for Winslet. I watched Jude, again, more nudity. Heavenly Creatures, again, more nudity. It was like, just, I could not find a film with her keeping her clothes on. Not that it's a bad thing, but...
Once I've finished the list, I'm debating doing some kind of infographic of her nudity in films and how much and how often. I haven't kept track, but if I were to do that, then the film that would have like, the most nudity in it is 2004's Pride, in which she voices a lion cub who is nude the entire time. Because it's a lion cub.
They seem like French girls.
Okay. On to the first of tonight's sections. We're going to go into release order tonight, I think, because it's going to be the best way of doing this. So we're going to start with Sapphire and Steel. Lucky, obviously, this was your choice. I'm assuming you were a fan of the show as soon as you chose it.
It was something where... it was a situation where Sapphire and Steel is kind of like on my short list of kind of like things to go to if I can't think of anything better. Every, you know, I have this like mental list and it's like, oh, we should do some Sapphire and Steel sometime. When you picked Dark Season, I thought it would be a, kind of like a good one to go along with it. Because, you know, British kind of sci-fi horror stuff kind of aimed at, I was always under the impression that Sapphire and Steel was kind of aimed at like, kind of like a, the same kind of like Doctor Who audience. I'm not entirely sure that's the case after this episode, but I don't know if I'd call myself a gigantic fan. But it is something I had heard of Sapphire and Steel through my Doctor Who fandom, through my interest in Doctor Who. Yeah. And, it was something where I had wanted, always kind of wanted to watch it, and this kind of gave me a good excuse for it.
Yeah, it's so. I don't know what to say about this one because I went into it not really knowing what Sapphire and Steel was. I know that it starred Ducky from NCIS, which I thought, you know, that's not bad, and it stars Hot Joanna Lumley.
As opposed to oh god, who does she, what was, is that Adina on what's the name of her character on Ab Fab? Patsy and Adina, I think it's Adina.
I think it is Adina, yes.
Never watched it. Scrolling. Don't know. Patsy. Yeah.
Patsy and Adina. Okay, yeah, then Adina must have been Saunders character. Okay. Yeah, I generally tend to think of David McCallum and Joanna Lumley, I tend to think of them as being the Russian guy from the original Man from U.N.C.L.E. And I think Joanna Lumley did a couple of Hammers. I think she actually did a couple of the I think she might have played like Peter Cushing's daughter or granddaughter in like Dracula AD 1971. One of those.
Well, I know David McCallum as being Ashley Pitch from The Great Escape. Great Escape is one of my favorite films.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so. I always forget he's in the... Well, there's so many people in The Great Escape.
I know. But that's like... When I started watching this, I'm like, oh my god, it's him! That's the only thing I've seen him in. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're completely right. Like, I mean, she was in... she played Jessica Van Helsing in The Satanic Rites of Dracula.
Satanic Rites of Dracula, yeah.
Which obviously was the last Hammer Dracula film to star Christopher Lee. For myself, when I think of her early career, though, I don't tend to think of her film career. I tend to think of her as Purdy in The New Avengers.
Right.
Which, obviously, whenever you mention the Avengers to my dad, it would just always be, like, this whole argument over which Avengers sidekick was hotter, whether it was Purdy or Diana Reagan. It's like, oh, for Christ's sake. This...
Honor Blackman.
Yeah, and it's...
Oh, it was... Scarlett Johansson.
It was sort of like... That's this, and I think that's why I was so kind of misled, because it being around the same period, I thought, oh, this is going to be kind of like the Avengers. But it's not really. It's kind of, as you say, it's more like got a more sort of a Doctor Who sort of theme to it. Certainly a starling. I mean, do you want to obviously explain what Sapphire and Steel is about?
Oh, I don't know anybody can explain what Sapphire and Steel is about. Quick kind of summary, and some of this is touched on in the opening serial, and some of this is just kind of stated throughout the series, and some of this is just really kind of like either supposition or implication. But very early on. I think it's in the – this is a show that was ran from 79 to 82 on ITV, produced by ATV, and it was created by Peter J. Hammond. Peter J. Hammond, probably best known, still alive, still active. He actually wrote a couple episodes of Torchwood, the first two seasons of Torchwood. In the opening serial, it is explained that time is kind of like a conscious force, and there are ways in which, and this is where it kind of gets sticky, whether they are malevolent entities that live within time or time itself, which may be a malevolent entity, can somehow break into the physical realm. And they manifest themselves in ways that are similar to ghosts, you know, spectral imagery, you know, things you can hear in the background, but, you know, strange noises, things you can hear in the background, but can't quite make out and stuff like that. To keep these malevolent forces from breaking through to the physical world and causing their some sort of destructive havoc, there is, as the opening narration of the intro explains, some sort of organization of individuals. It's not mentioned here, but I think it's the first serial where someone asks, I think it's Sapphire, "Are you aliens?" And she says, "Yes, in the extraterrestrial sense." So let's say they're individuals, and their job is to basically investigate and kind of put right these instances, these cracks through which malevolent forces can bleed into the physical realm. And Sapphire and Steel follows, big surprise here, all of these individuals are codenamed after like rocks or metals or elements, minerals of some sort. The two we follow throughout the series obviously are Sapphire and Steel. We meet two others over the course of the series. Silver, who is played by the great David Collings, who probably, if you're any familiarity with 70s British cult television, you would remember him as Chief Mover Poole from Doctor Who's Robots of Death. And then there's another one that he shows up a couple times, and then there's another one named Lead. But Sapphire and Steel, Sapphire being played by Joanna Lumley, Steel being played by David McCallum, are these alien individuals that basically their job is to show up on Earth. They have some capacity to travel in time. Most of the stories take place in the modern day. There is one that takes place, if I recall correctly, in the near future. There is one, I believe, that takes place in the 40s or 50s. And in this particular story, which, like I said, is called unofficially entitled The Man Without a Face, basically what happens, and it's never really explained kind of like how they find this out, but what draws them to this situation is that there's this abandoned shop of some sort, and children have kind of been showing up there that really shouldn't be there. And what happens is it basically turns out that one of these malevolent entities from within time has broken through. This is a little bit hard to understand. I think the implication is that this entity basically broke through by somehow managing to get itself into like the first photograph ever taken, and by extension, every photograph ever taken. And what it's doing is it's taking children out, photos of children, and embodying them. So they're not really the children themselves, but they're sort of like reflections of children, and putting other people into these photographs. And the original owner of the shop, that was his fate. And then about halfway through the first episode, we meet the lone remaining human resident of this this building, which has like a cellar and then the shop and then a couple flats above the shop, a woman named Liz, whose occupation we never get a clear read on, other than that she's always getting ready for work.
I think it's implied that she's a prostitute.
It's implied that she's the implication, yeah, was that she's a prostitute or a stripper. Because all she ever says is that she works at a club.
Well, she also says that she's used to like making hasty escapes in the morning, kind of thing. Lots of sneaking around.
A lot of kind of implications about her. But yeah, it is kind of implied that she's like one of the less savory professions. But basically, she's the only person, like human, like resident left. And this entity manifests itself. This entity can take the faces, various faces of people it's seen, but ordinarily he just basically shows up as a youngish man in a suit, you know, brown hair, but with literally no face, no facial features, no nose, ears, mouth, eyes, any. And what is, I think, probably the most striking effect, I thought very well done, considering that Sapphire and Steel was done in the late 70s, at a time when a lot of effects budgets were, if I recall correctly, in the late 70s, the British economy tanked for various reasons. And I think it was about on the kind of like on the edge of recovery, similar circumstances to what happened in the United States. But you can really tell that this story was done on a shoestring budget. In addition to Sapphire and Steel, you have, I think, 5 speaking roles and 3 sets across 100 minutes of content. So I think with what they were given, I thought they really pulled off the faceless man effect rather well. And it is the one, from what I've been able to tell, why I picked this particular one, other than it is only 4 parts, as opposed to some of the other ones, which are long, much longer, is that this seems to be the one that's best remembered. People always seem to remember the one with the man without a face, to the point where in the second series of the Doctor Who revival, one of the episodes, The Idiot's Lantern, written by Mark Gatiss, of the League of Gentlemen, but also a guy who really knows his British TV and film horror, put in kind of an homage to this story by including an entity which steals people's faces. So, it is a very interesting, I think, mix of genres. It's set up like science fiction. But it's very atmospheric, and it's filmed in a stark manner, recorded in a stark manner, and kind of presented almost as a ghost story. There's something, I think, very, if not necessarily gothic, very kind of very spooky Edwardian type thing going on here, with particularly the way the kids are lit, the children who come out of sepia-toned photographs, and kind of the way they light the kids and dress the kids. They dress them in these very drab gray garments, and they have certain lighting on them where they don't necessarily look sepia-toned, but they look kind of grayish and washed out. Those are kind of the positives. The negative, I would say, about this one in particular is that this is late 70s British science fiction. This is an incredibly slow-moving piece of entertainment. I remember thinking in episode 3, how long does it take one woman to get ready for work?
Yes.
You know? Particularly because Liz had been wearing, you actually see Liz putting the wig on. I think it takes her an entire episode just to get the wig in place.
Well, and those jangly bracelet things that,
yeah,
I was hoping would be relevant to the plot somehow, because they were really starting to annoy me. But every time she moves, just this clang, 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 clang. I'm like Tin Man walking around. And yeah, they play into it nothing. They're just there to be annoying.
Yeah. I mean, Jay, obviously, these shows were obviously thrust upon you for this episode because we're nice like that. I mean, what did you obviously make of Sapphire and Steel?
Well, I went into this, similar to you, Elwood, knowing absolutely nothing about the show other than I guessed that it would have two protagonists whose names would be Steel and Sapphire. I was kind of thought it would be something like Rosemary and Thyme, where they were just regular people who, and they were their surnames, and they were some kind of crime-fighting duo or whatever. So the whole science fiction aspect threw me a little bit, but I found it difficult to kind of, as Lackey was saying, really get a grip on the tone, because it's, you know, gothic in places with the kids and ghostly, but sci-fi and others, and I found that mix odd but not unappealing. I didn't hate this show. I'm not gonna watch any more, mainly because I didn't like the main characters of Sapphire and Steel. They seemed very humorless, very kind of stern, and lacked anything even resembling chemistry.
Yeah.
Which I was surprised that by these actors. I think it's more the case of the characters than anything else. They just seem very serious, very driven on their job.
It's very interesting because I often hear or see in pieces people write about this that Sapphire and Steel are supposed to have a flirtatious relationship, and I'm like, okay. This is like watching robots trying to flirt with each other.
There was one moment in the last episode where kind of Steel says that it must have been trying to impress all the ladies, and Sapphire says, well, at least he tried or something. And there's this barest hint of a smirk between the two of them. And then back to frozen face.
Yeah.
Back to turn that switch off. Back to normal. Default mode.
I found this one hard. I think mainly because I'm used to Darren McCollum actually giving me performances with some kind of life, rather than him just being a presence there. The same with Joanna Lumley. She's an actress who's got such energy, even if later roles when she's not playing the sex symbol role that she was playing, like obviously in the 70s, when you see her in things like Wolf of Wall Street. And she's got such presence and energy. And here, it's just both of them are just like a soul flatlined. And I went into it and they were sort of like doing the build up, and I thought, oh, this can be like an old school Doctor Who episode, like a Tom Baker years episode. And we have this slow build up, and, you know, by the time we get into the third and fourth episode, things will pick up pace and we'll have some sort of antics or some sort of action. There'll be like they'll pull some amazing resolution out of it. But it just was so plodding, the plotting here. And I just find it such a struggle to get through because, as you said, we watched the stripper woman get dressed for about three episodes. And I couldn't. The other thing which annoyed me is the fact that I couldn't place where it was supposed to be in sort of time, whether it's supposed to be in like the Victorian era, with obviously the way the man with no face is dressed and the children are dressed. And the fact that she puts on the record and it plays very modern music and she's like, oh, this is awful music, but I guess it's bearable. And I'm thinking, well, the only way that a character's going to sort of think like that is if they're like from that Victorian era and they played a piece of modern music. That's how they probably associate with it. So it kind of threw me off what the sort of time period was, and the fact that we're spending four episodes essentially watching these characters wander around a junk shop. They never really go outside apart from to the courtyard, and the very minor conflict between Sapphire and Steel and the man with no face is supposedly all-powerful entity. We occasionally get those Doctor Who style cliffhangers where Sapphire, she's being threatened by a bunch of youths holding umbrellas.
Yeah, the first cliffhanger. Yeah,
that was wonderful.
which again has that great resolution in the next episode. It's like, wait a minute, these are just paper.
Yeah.
Which I found kind of light. The moments I enjoyed were so few and far between here that I don't think I would come back to this series. It was kind of interesting for the first couple, but I think by the time I got into episode three, the charm, if any, of the show, I mean, such the neat little things like the actual man without a face, that cool little mask sort of effect that they use there, they were kind of wearing a bit thin, and the fact that nothing seemed to be happening just really sort of was getting to me. So it was kind of a struggle for the last, I would say, the from halfway between halfway of season episode three onwards. It was a bit of a struggle to get through this one, but
I couldn't quite work out why the faceless man was kind of collecting the children, like what he was doing, like why he wanted to do that. Like I have an issue with like unexplained villain plots in most superhero films, and this, because I don't know what his motivation was. Did he just want these kids to be able to play and not be stuck in a photo? The fact that they're in a photo, does that mean that their real life self is not play? I couldn't quite get behind the photo logic. Like at the end when he says to Liz that he paper burns, and she's told to burn every photograph of her there is and not have any more taken. Does that mean that if the faceless man comes back and does something to a photo of her, it would affect her real life self? Because that's making up new rules. And I wanted answers to that never came.
Yeah, it's... the rules are... Even the rules are, I think, kind of hard to get, one's mind around. They have... Sapphire and Seal have these kind of... They have certain... these powers that I seem to be fairly consistent. Sapphire can, take a subset of reality and forward, fast forward, or rewind through time. Steel, I think, has some sort of form of telekinetic power. He can freeze himself to pretty much absolute zero. My absolute favorite power, which I mentioned on Facebook, was that Sapphire, and this was one of my, I thought, really neat little effects. Sapphire has the power to read, apparently, mail without opening it. There's this one scene where she's just going through the old mail of the guy who had owned the shop before, and she's taking an envelope, putting her hand over it, and you'll hear this sort of vrr noise on the soundtrack, and she'll put it aside, and she'll wave her hand over the next one, and the same thing will happen, and you even keep hearing that vrr noise throughout the rest of the scene. She's continuing to read mail without opening the envelope.
As powers go, it's a pretty pathetic one.
Well,
if you give me an extra 10 or 15 minutes, I'll have the same information she does, just by opening them up and reading them, and open the next one up and reading it. Yeah, I didn't care.
But yeah, the slowness and... I mean, definitely the sort of alienness of the protagonist is definitely a feature, not a bug. But it is something that has... Like I said earlier, I tried to watch this series several times, and I never make it really past about two or three episodes into the second serial, which is like eight parts. Because it is just so slow. And it is just so... I don't want to knock something for having... I understand that it's a low-budget show. Probably most of the budget probably went into hiring McCallum and Loomley. But it's just watching four people wander throughout the same five sets for a couple of hours. It kind of gets annoying. Much in the same way that the early third season of Lost can get annoying, where it just seems like they're just going between the beach and some base and another base and the beach and some base and another base for like seven straight episodes.
And the hatch.
Yeah. Or the first three or four episodes of Heroes, where, which starts off with Peter Petrelli threatening to jump off a roof. And four episodes later, he's still standing on the top of that building, threatening to jump off the fucking roof. To the point where I want to just go into the picture, push Milo Ventimiglia off the roof, and say, "Get on with it, Flyboy."
Yeah, Heroes for myself. It's when they killed off the most interesting character, the heroin user who can predict the future when he's strung out on heroin.
Oh yeah,
I was like, that's if we're going to do a modern superhero show, that should be the basis, this sort of this Alan Moore style of superhero,
right,
where you can be a superhero but you got to be flawed, the same way that his version of Alan Quatermain's like a schoolgirl ass and pederast. in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And,
or Invisible Man is a lecherous rapist.
Yeah, it's this sort of flaw. And that's why when Heroes was announced and they were like going through these characters, it's all like, oh, we're going to have the Invincible cheerleader. And I was like, oh, that, you know, that's cool. And then it was like, oh, we've got this artist and he paints the future, but only when he's strung out in heroin. I was like, that's such an awesome idea. This is like a proper adult way of doing a superhero. It's because if it was a child's superhero, you can't do drugs and alcohol and those sort of dark elements. But obviously, if it's an adult show, you can. And they, of course, killed him off.
Yeah.
And I don't think I ever made it through the first season. It's, Heroes is one of those shows I need to go and watch just so I can say that I did it. Even though I've been forewarned that it pretty much falls off the rails and careers off the embankment towards a nuclear power station next to a school for bunnies.
Yeah,
that's
sort of
level of disaster.
As for myself, I gave it. Most people basically feel that it tend to feel that it jumped the shark around the time they did a flashback episode that was mostly in black and white. Not for any just a stylistic reason. When I say flashback episode, it flashbacks, I think, a whole 6 months into the past. But it is, other than it's hilarious, absolutely hilarious, because it does manage to put George Takei, Eric Roberts, and Christopher Eccleston all into the same scene. Somewhere, somebody's bingo card has been checked off there. Later on, the cop from Castle shows up with a bad Israeli accent for about 5 minutes. The problem with Heroes, of course, was that there was a writer's strike the following year. That was the fig leaf for that was, you know, that was, you know, the year after that was when we had our big, you know, Writers Guild strike. That really scuppered a lot of the plans for the second and third volumes. But honestly, I don't feel it ever really. I continued to watch it. I think a little bit into the third season, and at which point I just gave up and I said, I can't handle this anymore. I watched two episodes of Heroes Reborn and said, okay, this is just the same crap.
Well, you'd be happy to know Heroes Reborn has been axed.
Yes.
Yeah, the hatches really swung wide and far this year on series. There's been a lot of shows that have been axed after one season. Limitless has faced the axe.
Yeah.
At the same time, we've got this whole slew of shows based on films coming out. I mean, we've got Lethal Weapon. We've got New MacGyver coming out. We've got Training Day, the TV series. We've got Rush Hour, the TV series.
Rush Hour, I think over here it's already premiered.
Yeah,
it has here as well, yeah. Okay. You just listed a bunch of stuff I'm never going to watch.
I think this is the thing.
That's kind of the point.
It's either that or the reinventing shows such as 24... has got some sort of spin-off. The Blacklist has got a spin-off. Kevin James is essentially doing King of Queens again, but with a different show.
My mother asked me, it's like, why is he playing the same thing again? And I'm like,
my
response to this is, well, he's got to do something. He's got to do something, you know, between, you know, the acting gigs that his friend, the movie gigs that his friend Adam Sandler gets him.
Yeah.
So why is he doing the same thing again? You could say that for everything he ever releases.
It's so. Like, has he ever done anything other than the same old thing? The thing that got axed, it got axed before it even got ordered, before it even aired, or really ordered to series, was they were going to do a grim and gritty adult Nancy Drew series. Which I thought sounded like it had potential, but they're not going forward with that.
So a grim and gritty version. Is she strung out heroin as well?
That's what I was hoping. You know, I was hoping that it would be kind of like the Veronica Mars movie would have been like if it had been Seven. You know, so
I might have watched it.
Well, keep in mind Veronica Mars, because that will actually may tie into what we're going to be covering next week. But
hey,
we'll be going into that at the end of the show. I mean, obviously back to Sapphire and Steel. I mean, do we have anything else to really say about this? Because for myself, it was just... It wasn't a fun experience. I mean, this is a show that never officially had an ending. I think if I'm to be writing from what I've read, it basically ends them with them in a trapped in an intergalactic motorway cafe.
Yeah. And basically, they never made any more because David McCallum and Joanna Lumley, they had busy schedules, they had other things to do, and they just didn't feel like doing it anymore.
Nope.
Apparently, there is a reboot or remake in development from Neil Cross, the creator of Luther, who also contributed a couple scripts to the final half season of Matt Smith's run on Doctor Who, a couple of the really, really good scripts, including, I can't remember the name of it, but it was the one that starred Dougray Scott and Jessica Raine.
Okay.
So,
Luther's the one with Idris Elba, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. No, the only reason that it just came to mind, because I have a friend over here in the UK, we've just recently added a feature on Skyboxes where if you're watching a TV show, if they've got the box set, you can actually flick to the next episode, and in the Idris Elba shows up at the end of every episode, and my friend is very keen to know that if they press the green button, if Idris Elba will show up or not. I think they're not so bored about watching the TV, it's just more the fact of Idris Elba showing up on their couch they're very excited about. And then it's sort of like, oh, it doesn't appear to work. Oh, why don't we play Twister or something? So
that sounds like
Idris Elba on your couch.
That sounds like Will Slater's nightmare.
Oh, God, yeah.
Now, one thing I did, I don't know if we've been on Saffron still, we mentioned the faceless man. The image of him kind of turning around in the photos, like a montage of him flipping from photo to photo and turning around. I really liked that image and what they did with that. I found that a very, very kind of creepy and evocative kind of image.
Yeah, I thought it was, for the most part, this is something that ordinarily would have been in my wheelhouse. You know, very claustrophobic, intimate, very creepy, very spooky. I think maybe I would have enjoyed it a lot more if it had been cut down to two episodes.
Yeah.
I think this is the sort of thing that, I think there's a lot of potential in doing a remake of this. You know, using modern storytelling convention. You know, if you compress these things into a nice condensed hour or hour and a half, I think it would be a lot more effective.
And I think they could have done more with the whole trapping people in a photo and setting fire to it and killing
them.
Yeah. I think that was an interesting concept that it didn't really take far enough, maybe. I'm not sure. Because it would be good if we'd like gotten to know the person in the photo who died.
Right.
That kind of thing. Yeah, I'm not sure how they would have done that with this plot, but
yeah,
that's all I have about this, really.
Same here.
Right. I mean, on that note, we're just going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we'll be looking at our second selection of the evening. We'll be looking at The Dark Season.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
And we're back. Still joining me, as always, I've got my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hi.
And our special guest tonight, Mr. Jay Clewitt from Life vs. Film.
Hello.
In the first half, we obviously looked at Sapphire and Steel. Now, still on our Doctor Who-esque trip, we're going to skip slightly forward in time through to 1991 to the Russell T. Davis scripted The Dark Season. This is my selection for this particular episode, and this is a show which really stuck with me from my early childhood. The main reason being that it scared the bloody crap out of me as a child. And this was shown at tea time, so this is 5 o'clock showing, and this was scary as hell back then. I'm probably going to get blistered because probably watching this as adults, it's probably not that scary, but this is had the same presence and feeling of watching like old Doctor Who, like Sylvester McCoy years, and it's been rumored that this script for The Dark Season started off as a rejected script that Russell T. Davis had submitted back in 1987 to Andrew Cartmell at the time, and he basically had it rejected and turned it into the script that we have now. Obviously, Russell T. Davis is probably best known for Doctor Who and doing Queer as Folk, so this is kind of an oddity, and it's kind of a shame we never saw more of these projects with him. And the most we ever saw was obviously his work on the revival of Doctor Who. The season itself, it's 6 episodes long, and it's split essentially 2 stories joined together. The first 3 episodes, seeing this mysterious fellow called Mr. Eldritch, who has got bleach blonde hair, wears dark shades, wears dark overcoats all the time, and just speaks in a menacing tone all the time. And basically, he's turns up at this school, and he's given away free computers. And of course, our little trio of heroes, here we have Tom Reet, played by the young Kate Winslet, and the female Doctor Who, I want to call her, and General Misfit, Marcy, played by Victoria Lambert, who is younger than both Tom and Reet and has taken to carrying a paddle around with her for no real reason apart from, as she explains it, whereas you never know when you'll be up the creek. Again, this is the Doctor Who reference coming in there, but as they soon discover, these computers are part of a plot by Mr. Eldritch that plans to use them to mind control the students and create a little mini uprising. The second story we have sees an introduction of a new villain of sorts. We have Miss Pendragon, the turban-wearing neo-Nazi, who's determined to dig up the supercomputer known as the Behemoth, which conveniently has been buried under the school. And for these series, it's really this idea of technology and Deus Ex Machina being combined within this sort of Grange Hill high school setting. So
it's like Grange Hill meets Black Mirror.
Kind of.
Yep, I can see that. How the heck do you know what Grange Hill is?
because how do he's I know an Anglophile.
Because I'm an right. Anglophile.
I get that, but there's a limit. There should be a limit to your Anglification.
I've never seen Grange Hill.
Okay.
Are you a fan of Biker Grove?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Good.
The main thing I know, I think the main reason I have heard of Grange Hill is because the headmaster, if I remember correctly, the headmaster on that show was played by the guy who played Hitler in Last Crusade, Michael Sheen.
And they did a survey in Empire magazine once where they were doing the best Hitler lookalikes, and his was the highest rated.
That's chaps, boy.
The one that came second was the one who was in the bunker.
Bruno Ganz?
Yeah, Bruno Ganz.
From Downfall.
Downfall, yeah. He was he came second.
I can see that. Where did Chaplin come?
I'm not too sure where Chaplin came. I think he came around the same place as the guy who played Hitler in Hail Honey, I'm Home. The BBC's attempt at making Hitler into a sort of sitcom character. I think that's the one for another show, but...
Well, yeah. I mean, you're the people that managed to can't come up with Allo Allo, so...
Mm. But
what's your problem with Allo Allo? I see no issues with that show.
I've never seen it.
That show is wonderful. I mean, I'll say that only once.
Yeah, I mean, this is 1991, so this is back when the BBC was putting out quality output, rather than now where they basically take your money and force you to watch whatever they churn out. Right from the start, it's got that Doctor Who sort of atmosphere to it. It's got the moody music. It's got this sort of creeping sense of dread and this feeling that you're not sure what's going on, but there's clearly something afoot. And it's got, it very carefully teases it out, and we get weird zombie children in the first episode. In the second one, we get this super creepy computer that's got a life of its own, and there's so many wonderful elements that even now, yes, some of the effects aren't particularly great. The computers look awful.
There's only about 5 minutes of incidental music, and they keep repeating it over and over and over throughout the episodes. That's also something it has in common with Sylvester McCoy or Doctor Who.
But, I mean, obviously, Lucky, you're our resident Doctor Who fan. So, what did you obviously make of the Dark Season? I mean, obviously, this is, for myself, very similar to the Sylvester McCoy years, so...
Well, the first thing I have to, of course, point out here is the presence of not only Jacqueline Pierce as Miss Pendragon. Jacqueline Pierce, of course, best known for playing Servalan on Blake 7, which was kind of like a a twin series to Doctor Who for a while, but also in the I don't remember his name, but the computer programmer or the computer the guy that the sort of guy's like, oh, the with the Polish name, that guy was played by Cyril Shapps, who was probably best known. He did several Doctor Whos. He's known for dying off in over-the-top ways in an old Doctor Who, but he is, I think, the main human baddie in the definitive cyber story, Tomb of the Cybermen from 67, and or 68, one of those years. It starts with a 6.
And Bridget Forsyth, who played Miss Maitland, apparently was Ruth Maxtable. Evil of the Daleks.
The evil that I wouldn't have run that because Evil of the Daleks, there's like only like 5 minutes of that left anymore.
Well, this is all according to IMDb. I have no idea if it's true or not.
It's probably true. It's probably true. Really, you can definitely tell. According to the Wikipedia page for Dark Season, the only conscious reference to Doctor Who that Davis is willing to admit to is, I think when we first meet Marcy, she's playing with a yo-yo, and that's an obvious homage to Tom Baker's Doctor Who, and I think this was also something that was picked up by the Sylvester McCoy one on a couple of occasions. Would use a yo-yo to judge gravity.
It's Reet, it's Kate Winslet who's got the yo-yo, because the three kids they have a thing each. She's got a yo-yo. Marcy's got the paddle, and Thomas always has a skateboard with him, which at one point he throws very pathetically at some people trying to attack him. He just kind of passes the skateboard to their feet.
and various people have mentioned, noticed other, kind of possible links to Doctor Who. There's definitely kind of like really the second story, the Behemoth story. Really, I think, kind of reminds me of like some of the classic Tom Baker, the more philosophical ones. I'm tempted to bring up another one, The Face of Death, where Tom Baker lands on a. That's the story that introduced Leela. Tom Baker lands on a planet where they have carved Tom Baker's face into a mountain, and he's got to find out why. And it's one of those evil computer stories. But in this case, he kind of talks the evil computer. He basically plays kind of like psychologist to it, and trying to clear up its neuroses through the talking cure instead of just blowing it up. And that's almost akin to what Marcy does in the final episode, where they have this kind of discussion with her and Eldritch and the computer, where they're basically trying to the computer's trying to figure out should I destroy the world. These are Doctor Who-ish plots, if nothing else. Even the structure of the protagonist, where Marcy is definitely kind of the leader of the crew and the smart one, and she takes a mentorial kind of error with the other two. She's always her recurring phrases. If it's one thing I've taught you, it's that to never do this. It's to never guess. It's to never make assumptions, or it's to always ask questions and stuff like that. To the other two, who would basically, people have mentioned, Marcy is the doctor, Reet and Thomas are the companions. These are Doctor Who type stories. They've got they have their explosions. They have their golly gee wow action stuff. But at the center of it, there's kind of like a philosophical or a moral conundrum. It's not just about blowing things into oblivion. It's really about kind of it's not. I think this is. You can tell this is very early on in Davis's career, because he doesn't. Because he doesn't, not all of these things are thought out or developed as coherently as they could be. And it's the one that really cracked me up is the central twist of the first three episodes is that, and I can't remember the character's name again, but the Cyril Shapps character.
Polzinski.
Yeah.
Polzinski. The whole thing is that Eldritch and his little clique of like computer, you know, millennial computer nerds. They worship this guy who had made this human computer interface, and they want to use it to destroy the world. And they've even kidnapped him. It turns out that he, in a, by a stroke of luck, he lives in the same neighborhood as like Reed and Thomas. And there's this basic twist that they have him and they need him to help, but you know, the twist is, of course, is that they've only ever known him by his last name. So what they don't, you know, they don't know is that he's not the computer genius in the family. His wife is, you know, and because they've only ever known the name Professor Whatever, they don't know that it's actually a woman, which was probably, it's actually a very clever twist until you realize, yes, they're obsessed with this guy, but they've done absolutely no research on him.
I love the fact she pulls the old school computer out of a trunk.
I mean, you know, trust the, you know, trust the British to put, you know, to put a whiz bang piece, a whiz bang laptop PC into a crate that looks like it would be used to house an Enigma machine.
Yeah. I mean, Jay, I mean, obviously, again, this is another thing we thrust upon you. Mainly for the Kate Winslet connection.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what was your thoughts on the Dark Seas? I mean, you're obviously a fellow Brit. I mean,
how can you tell?
Yes. Well-spoken tone? How did we ever guess? I mean, remember this as a kid? Or was
no, this came out when I was four. So I was a little young for it. And I have only ever been familiar with it because I've just seen it on Kate Winslet's TV and thought, I don't review her TV stuff. I'll never have to watch that. It's fine. Until today. And I can't say I overly enjoyed this experience. I'm not a fan of Russell T. Davies. He's one of the reasons I kind of stopped watching Doctor Who. I think Lackey just got up and left. No. And this...
Hey, you're allowed.
this show has some of my problems with his writing. For example... The twist at the end of that first half, where it's revealed it's the wife is the professor, fine with that twist, but there's kind of a Deus Ex Machina element to it, where she's got this rival code, rival program that she wants to upload, and that will stop the whole evil plan. And I've found that Russell T. Davies has a tendency to do this with his writing. He'll always introduce some kind of element right at the end that hasn't been mentioned ever beforehand, and that will save the day in the last few minutes. And I don't like that kind of writing. I find that to be pretty lazy. And we have that here. So the first half of this I didn't much care for. Second half, just it's ridiculous, and I had a bit more fun with. Like, just the awful wigs. All those... terrible blonde wigs everyone's wearing, and all the kids in their like pastel sweatsuits.
Yeah,
everyone's wearing pastel in this film. No one wears pastel. No one's ever worn pastel, even in the early 90s.
I love the fact that there is a reviewer stumbled across on the BBC cult section, and you've got these four reviewers, and I think they've obviously come to this as adults, and that they're criticising. It's like, oh, you can tell the budget because of how cheap the wigs were looking. I'm thinking, no, this is how BBC productions generally looked back then. The stories are obviously better, but at the same time, there wasn't the money to really invest in sets and props and things. And it's certainly when you look at things like the Sylvester McCoy Doctor 2 years, and the fact that they filmed like episodes like Greatest Show on Earth, and it was all basically shot in a tent in a car park.
Yeah.
And there's some real creativity in those sort of episodes, and where effects either worked or they really didn't. There was no sort of go-between. And I think because I was like coming up watching those things and being of that era and seeing what else was on, I was a little more forgiving when I see things like those awful blonde wigs. The fact that because someone, the supposedly chosen Nazi, we should call him, falls down a hole and hurts his arm, that he somehow can't be used in the machine, despite the fact he doesn't have to use his arms at all.
Right, that's the thing. The Pendragon wants to have this perfect specimen to be the sacrifice for the machine, but that's just something she wants and isn't anything necessary.
Yeah.
And I felt like that just added an episode to this this ordeal. Like, that was the plot of episode 4. Just keeping this figure intact, and then he breaks his arm and says, oh, let's use Thomas instead. For no reason to use Thomas either. Anyone could have done that, and I found that frustrating.
Yeah, but Thomas, they're like, oh, he's the chosen one. He's got blonde hair, and then it's like,
it's died.
Wait a minute, your hair's died.
Painted heathen. And just the three main characters are unbearable. All three. Reed and Thomas are just stupid, and not usefully so. They're a hindrance. I don't know why Marcy hangs out with them. They just kind of get in the way all the time. And Marcy, I couldn't stand being in her presence. I found it just intolerable as a character.
Okay. I mean, obviously, it's like he mentioned a minute ago, that when we get to the scene with the behemoth at the end, and you've got this sort of like scene where they're trying to reason with the behemoth so it can decide whether it's going to destroy the world as it's essentially been programmed to do, or if it's going to shut itself down. For myself, it really brought to mind the End of War Games, where Matthew Broderick teaches the war computer that you can have a draw through the use of tic-tac-toe. And it just felt like that scene was being played in a different way. The fact that it was teaching Behemoth, you know, that you don't have to have a win or lose situation. The fact that, you know, you can just shut yourself down and have a draw, essentially.
Yeah, you don't have to play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the most irritating aspect for myself is our little SWAT character.
Oh, Olivia.
Who, again, this is she's a real Doctor Who style character, she is, where she's there with little nerdy glasses and
she's like Velma.
And a lovely pastel sweater. And, of course, she turns into a weird zombie child because of she gets subjected to this program of symbiosis, which is obviously going to throw the world into chaos in this first story. And the scene where she's in the back of the teacher's car, I remember scaring the hell out of me as a child.
How old were you when you watched this? I need to understand why you were scared.
Let me see. So born 83, 91, so I don't know.
Eight, nine. Okay, I understand that then.
We were easily scared back in the 90s. We'd just come out of a Cold War, for Christ's sake. People were a lot more scared back then, but well, no, jaded, obviously, as you lot were, obviously, watching this now as an adult.
Yeah, it's not designed for 28-year-olds.
No. I mean, but saying that, I mean, I enjoyed the story still. I thought it's fun. Yes, it's a bit cheesy in places, but I just generally enjoyed what we would now, obviously, what before we would say was a Doctor Who vibe, and now, which as Lucky you think said at the start, there would be more of a Black Mirror-esque vibe that this has to it. Especially with its dependence on technology being a main running theme. I mean, if you read the book of this, there is actually a setup for a third story involving an evil arcade owner. So whether Eldrick came back for that one or not, I'm not too sure, because essentially from all circumstances here, he gets vaporized at the end of the second story. I mean, did we have any thoughts on his character? I mean, he is kind of like the Bond villain school of acting.
I called him Nazi Neo. That's what I refer to him as. And I didn't mind him at all. He was like a bit of an engaging presence. Him and Pendragon in the second half. I liked them both as villains go.
Yeah.
But when he returns as the big villain of the second half as well, it's like he's been away for half a season instead of almost an entire episode. He's like, oh my god, Eldritch is back. It's that guy from like months ago when we first saw him.
It's that guy from 2 weeks ago.
It's that guy from, the episode I watched 10 minutes ago.
Yeah. Him.
Okay. That seems like a bit of a letdown.
In terms of like internal storytelling time, it's like it happened, like from what the implication is that there's been the first three episodes and the second three episodes are divided by an entire weekend. Which could explain why everybody is wearing the same clothes.
It was probably filmed the same day.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we mentioned already Miss Maitland, the teacher, the only adult ally these kids have. I mean, it takes her six episodes to finally tap into her badass self, where she slowly demolishes a water pipe using a digger. In probably was the what probably was considered the height of action back in the early 90s.
I was on the edge of my seat. yeah, she goes through a lot. She has to take a lot of insults from these three kids. They just keep telling her running how old she is and how they don't expect her to like, go along with their wacky schemes because she's too old. I'm thinking she looks like what, mid-30s?
You know,
granted,
shots.
when you're a child, you think your teachers are ancient, but still.
I wasn't even clear at the beginning whether Marcy was like a student or a TA, because she just obviously, I guess the character is supposed to be 13, but Victoria Lambert is so clearly not 13 years old. You know, it was like the episode of Buffy we watched where at one point the techno-pagan girlfriend that they set up for Giles, I was like, is she faculty? Because there are students that look older than her.
Yeah.
She
has got that little Jimmy Cranky vibe to her.
Yeah. but it's, yeah, that's a, yeah, if we're making the Doctor Who parallels, she's the Brigadier. She's always perpetually put upon and always having to clean up other people's messes and has kind of like a sort of brute force attitude. You just kind of towards solving problems, you just basically deny that a problem exists for the entire story, for the first few parts of the story, and then the third act, you basically pick like one method and just pull through it until you get through it or somehow just make it through the episode without dying or being insulted to death.
I mean, anyone else take anything away from this at all? Or is
I want to mention Kate Winslet's hair in this, which is, there's your number one sign that this was made in 1991, is that I'm pretty sure her hair, that weird color red that only comes out of cans of Manic Panic hair dye, you know, that specific shade I think actually is called Mickey Berenyi from Lush Red.
Well, it's a precursor to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. You know, that's why she got cast in that. It's because she can dye her hair red.
Well, there you go.
It's the only reason.
Yeah. I mean, for myself, I mean, The Dark Season, it sits in that special group of shows that I remember fondly from my childhood. It wasn't like Grange Hill or Biker Grove, where it was all about teaching about moral consequences of things. And this was just essentially like a fun Doctor Who-esque show that basically filled in the gap because at that point Doctor Who was winding down. I mean, Sylvester McCoy was sort of seeing out the last few episodes. So, I mean, you obviously had this, you had the Demon Headmaster.
I was about to say that. That's my equivalent as the Demon Headmaster.
A lot of people confuse this with the Demon Headmaster. Did you find the Demon Headmaster scary? Because that traumatized me as well as a child.
I don't remember. I remember watching it, and I remember the main guy in it being someone I might have considered scary, but I don't know if I was scared of him or not. I can't say. I have this massive blind spot in my head of all TV I watched as a child. I cannot remember anything. I was talking to my parents the other day. I went to a family wedding, and my mum was saying how I used to play Power Rangers with my neighbor after school one day, or most days, and I can't remember ever watching Power Rangers. I can't remember. I couldn't tell you anything about it. Same with the Ninja Turtles. I apparently had a cake of one of the turtles, but I don't remember ever watching it. I still don't know which one's Shredder, which one's Splinter. I don't know which of the turtles is which. I think I must have had some kind of aneurysm or something in my past, where I just forget all this stuff.
I love the Turtles.
I apparently did.
I love the fact that in Britain, the censors were down on nunchuckers. So whenever Michelangelo charged at the screen, they cut out his nunchuckers, so he's just always using a fist. And in the films, they had to like constantly give him improvised weapons, so hence he's shown garroting someone with a string of sausages. Yeah.
Well, this is the same board who didn't like them being called mutants. They're to be heroes, isn't it?
It was
teenage hero Ninja Turtles.
Ninjas.
No, I thought they were going to have to be mutants.
No, they were Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles.
Okay, I thought they were Teenage Hero Ninja Turtles.
No,
okay.
In the States they were Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes, yes. That seems ridiculous, even more so.
Yeah, the censorship board didn't like the word ninja either.
Why do we live in this country?
Well, you could live in my country.
No, thank you.
We've got Donald Trump running for president.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah.
I'm not even sure what the British equivalent of that would be. I don't know. The guy from that...
Piers Morgan.
Piers Morgan. I mean,
you can keep that guy.
They sent him back to us.
We sent him back to you. We don't want him anymore.
Okay. Yeah, you kept the receipt on that one.
Yeah.
I just have to ask, it's sort of like, you're going over there, essentially on a visa, and your whole strategy is to piss off your hosts by challenging one of their core beliefs, the right to bear arms. And you, as the person here who's not a citizen, is going to go over there and tell them how to run their country. And you're surprised when they get pissed at you.
Yeah, we don't like that.
Yeah.
Even if, as a rule, we don't agree with it, even if we would agree with the foreigner, in this case, we don't tend to go for that kind. We don't we just really don't like other countries for the most part.
You just don't stand for that kind of shit.
We just don't stand for this whole kind of thing, like disagreeing with us. You know, we'll go to war with you.
Speaking of tales, Kevin Eastman, I met him once while I was working in Birmingham Airport. Very nice man. And who had also gone to create Heavy Metal.
Yeah. Not create Heavy Metal. He
worked on it.
Yeah, he resurrected it, I guess. Okay.
Well, I thought he was awesome. And you can also see him. He turns up in Return to Savage Beach.
Oh.
So, if you... it's part of the Triple B series by Andy Sedaris, Babes and Bullets.
Yeah.
Because he was married to a former playmate at one point.
He was married to... Oh, God, I used to know who he was married to. He was married to a former playmate, and he would always have these he would always have these playmates, whoever were like the more recent playmates.
Yeah.
And he'd always find a way to stick Julie Strain in there as well. But my personal favorite of that little batch being the Dallas connection because of my crush on Miss December, I think 1990, Wendy Hamilton.
Yeah, I made Will watch Hard Ticket to Hawaii for the episode of Exploding Helicopter podcast that I appeared on. So yeah. Definitely check out his show if you're not already. Will Slater over explodinghelicopter.com. His show, Exploding Helicopter podcast, is available on iTunes and Podomatic, so well worth checking out.
He's just on a show on Machete Kills.
He's kind of like our go-to guy for anything involving exploding helicopters. And he's obviously been on the show. We had him on to talk about the Night Stalker and X-Files. And he's definitely a great guy to go on. He's kind of like the reverse Hulk. We love him when he gets angry.
Yeah. and that's often. It's always entertaining. Yeah.
But obviously the Dark Season, before we obviously... get on to what we've
been mentioned. That thing.
What do we have any final thoughts? I mean, I think it stands up. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun watch, and the fact it's 6 episodes long, so 3 hours in total. It's not a big time suck, and you know, it's enjoyably daft, especially if you're a Doctor Who fan, an old school Doctor Who fan, I should
say. Yeah, it definitely has a lot of that vibe. And you know, the Sylvester McCoy era, that final era, really is not my favorite era of Doctor Who. I'm very much a sort of late Pertwee, early Tom Baker, mid-70s type of guy when it comes to my taste in Doctor Who. But there are some adorable stories from that era. And that is the sort of thing where, you know, if you wonder what it would have been like, you know, if they had done another series with Sylvester McCoy, this is kind of really kind of got a good... will give you a good feel of kind of like what kind of place it kind of held in British popular culture at the time. It's definitely dated. You know, it's definitely dated. It's, you know, these ideas of what computer you could do with a computer, the idea of whether big baggy knee shorts were ever a good idea. You know, again, you know, stuff like that. You know, it looks 1991. It is, I think it does kind of require a certain kind of mindset. You kind of have to be able to appreciate. And as with Sapphire and Steel, you've got to be able to kind of look past a shoestring budget. And it is a peculiar sort of strain of, I guess, children's adventure, sci-fi adventure, fantasy adventure story. I enjoyed it. I don't know if I would ever have wanted a full season of it, or a full, like, three or four seasons of it. I don't know if I could watch it, but all that much of it. But I enjoyed it for what it was. It was fun.
Cool. Jay?
No.
Okay.
I didn't enjoy it, and although it was fun. I'm in no way surprised that of the main three actors, only Kate Winslet went on to do anything else, because the actors that played Marcy and Thomas, not great.
Yeah.
Often not great. I know it's you kind of roll on the dice with child actors, and they got snake eyes. I'm pleased I've crossed it off the Kate Winslet list. It's not the worst thing she's been in. You know, movie 43, A Kid in King Arthur's Court.
It was in A Kid in King Arthur's Court?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
With a young Daniel Craig.
Oh my God.
And there's an animated film called Fairies with an E, where there should be no E, which is just awful and has some of the worst CGI I've ever seen. That's probably the bottom three of what Winslet has done. Wow. Never watched that. Jeremy Irons and Digory Scott are in there as well. They voice characters. It's just awful.
Yeah.
Just she's done some really, really bad films.
Well, I mean, that's our two main selections. Obviously, in a slight change up to the format. Start to round out the show, I mean, let's just quick look at what's obviously been holding our attention in the time since our last episode. I mean, Lucky, did you want to go first?
I think Jay should go first.
Okay, Jay. What have you been watching?
Okay, well, this is the time of year where I turn my TV on, because I don't watch a great deal, but Game of Thrones is back.
Yep.
Is it? Couldn't tell.
Yeah.
They've only been advertising for 6 months. So.
I know, and now they're still doing it, but they'll stop in 5 weeks' time, in theory. Can we do spoilers?
We're going to say there will be spoilers ahead.
Okay.
I'm trying not to give anything too major away, just because I know there are people out there still binging, and people get very upset when you spoil Game of Thrones. So,
ooh, okay. I have some stories about that, but never mind.
I'll hold the door shut on the spoilers then.
Okay. There we go.
Okay, so I am kind of liking the season so far. Season 6 we're up to. But I really like the parts of Game of Thrones where it's set in like the heart of Westeros, and the storylines are kind of affecting one another, and people are traveling from one place to another, and you kind of know what their mission is. So
yeah.
I'm not a massive fan of what's going on with Bran at the moment, where with the tree, with Max von Sydow tree guy, because I don't know where that's going, and I just don't like Bran as a character. Similarly, I really like Arya as a character, but I don't like her storyline at the moment because it's just separate from everyone else.
Yeah.
And doesn't seem like it's going to affect anyone else. And I want people to be interacting with one another, and there's just too much magic and nonsense going on. I like people fighting and the big battle scenes.
Yeah.
I'm quite surprised that I like what's going on over on Pyke on the Iron Islands, because in the book, that was interminable to get through. When that was like half of one of the longer books, and it was a real slog to get through that. But they seem to be going through at quite a brisk pace in the show, which, well done for them. Good job on condensing that.
The Iron Islands, they're the naval fleet people, is that right?
Yeah, it's where Theon is from.
Okay.
The Greyjoys.
Yeah, because someone posted this, I think just before I came on I caught this, the fact that we have, I'm just going to want spoiler ahead, the fact that we have 12 people watching someone have a salt bath and he gets into power compared to the person who with an army of 40 steals half the Navy.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I think that meme would have been posted by me.
I think it probably was you, Lucky. So
because I did post it and basically say it's like what's the deal here? Is it the Iron Islands have a dysfunctional Iron Electoral College, or is it just that they're a bunch of sexist dicks?
A bit from column A and a bit from column B, I think.
Yeah.
But I just the line that followed that, "Where's my niece and nephew? Let's go murder them." Just what? What is why? Who would? How does no one turn around and think we want this guy to lead us? Mm. He just no. That's no. He has no kind of tact.
One of my favorite fan sites is Chris Watches Game of Thrones, where she takes screen caps and puts like alternate dialogue in there, and she basically has decided that the woman who does that has basically decided that Euron Greyjoy is Donald Trump. So he keeps saying things like, I have a $1 billion boat, I can make a million boats, if I get people to make boats, I'll make them pay for it, I can make them for $3 a boat. It's
he hilarious. Has all the best words.
He does.
Yeah. I'm going to see him in a whole new light now. I think that may have saved
it was
Euron for me.
It was not quite as funny as the plot line where apparently Stannis had decided he was Batman, which resulted in Jon saying to him once, "The reason Mance won't bend the knees because you're a fucking nerd."
So would that make Davos Alfred?
That makes about as much sense as any other interpretation of Davos.
I like Davos. I want him to do
Oh, Davos
stuff.
Is great. Liam Cunningham, always liked him.
Yeah. And the fact that, like, the little group that has just left the wall, looking forward to them. And I'm loving the whole Tormund and Brienne. It's one of my favorite parts of Game of Thrones, just in general.
The animated GIF that Heather Baxendale posted of Tormund giving Brienne the eye and just looking away like, what the fuck have I gotten myself into?
I just was sat watching that for minutes.
I love that. Oh God. It's great to have Jon and Sansa together. It's nice to actually have Starks together in the same place for first time since like 2012.
As soon as Sansa set off to go and see Jon at the wall, I thought, okay, which one of them's going to die before she gets there? Because Starks do not meet. This is not.
Right.
This does not happen.
Right.
but their storyline is the one that I'm liking at the moment because they have a goal. They have a mission they're trying to do. They're trying to take back the North. And so I can see what's going on there. Everyone else is just, I don't know what's going on anywhere. Even down in like King's Landing, with Cersei and Tyrion, I can't remember why Marjorie's in prison. I don't know what she's doing in there.
It's I can't even remember that. It's just sort of like, I am just sick to death of Jaime and Cersei by now.
Yeah.
Which it's kind of strange. You know, my two favorite actors on the show, Lena Headey and Nikolai Coster-Waldau, are like my two least favorite characters on the show. It's like, you know, particularly last season where it was just like Cersei, just let's spin the wheel of paranoia. And who have we decided is responsible for Joffrey's death this week? You know, who's in league with Tyrion to take everything I love away from me? And it was just, with the Walk of Shame, it did actually manage to, I think a major miracle in making me feel some actual sympathy for her. You know, like she's like some sort of human being, and not just like a card against humanity come to life. But it's just like this whole thing of, we need a way to undercut the Tyrell influence. We need to get, you know, Marjorie's got too much influence over Tommen. So let's arm the Faith Militant. Let's get rid of the old High Sept and put Jonathan Pryce in there. Oh, wait, Jonathan Pryce is out of control? He's our enemy. You know, and it's just like, oh, Christ, you know, do you ever, like, face the consequences of your actions?
And as much as I like Jonathan Pryce, I'm looking forward to when he dies, because that character has to die at some point, and it's going to be good. But how great was it to see Richard E. Grant in there?
Oh, my God!
I had no idea!
I would never have recognized him. Like, I mean, I would have recognized him, like, once he took off the makeup,
yes.
and, like, the zone of arrogance goes up. Because, like, Richard E. Grant, love him, but he's got that zone of arrogance around him.
Yeah.
You know, where you just, you know, you just want to punch him in the face once you get within a mile of him. But he's a great actor.
He's a
terrific
actor.
But I never would have recognized him if my friend hadn't pointed out, oh, yeah, there's Richard E. Grant. Oh, Richard E. Grant's in this. Cool.
Yeah. I didn't notice until, as you say, he took the makeup off. And
yeah, he took the makeup off. And then he looks exactly like, you know, Richard E. Grant.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Well, he would, but yeah.
I have to say, this season has left me a little underwhelmed. I've not had the same sort of buzz that I've had off the previous seasons. I'm not sure if it's because George R. R. Martin has gone off to write the final book.
Has he done?
I don't know. Apparently he's not involved in this season.
No, he hasn't been involved in the last couple seasons.
And this season, it just... Because there's a lot of new material, am I right in saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've reached the end of the books for pretty much all the storylines.
Part of me, when I was watching the end of the last episode, the one that just aired, and I can't help but had this funny idea of George R. R. Martin there. He's writing, finishes the final book, and it's like, and Hodor sits on the Iron Throne, and he and he was the pimp daddy. And then he looks up and sees, oh, Game of Thrones on. Let's see what's happening on Game of Thrones this week. And then he's just jaw drops, and he just realizes they fucked up the bloody series. And has to go back and rewrite the book because they keep screwing around with his characters. So I don't know. I'm hoping that it's going to pick up the next few episodes. And now we've sort of moved people around into new positions. We've introduced new characters and established where old characters are and what they're actually doing. We've got past that whole cliffhanger of the previous season that things are going to pick up. I mean, we've already got the zombie version of the Mountain, which I've been enjoying.
Yep.
But yeah, there's at the moment, I mean, the old Mother of Dragons, I don't think she seems to be making any sort of progress at all. She just seems to be going in one big circle.
I've never liked Dany's storyline. Even in the books and on the show, I've always found her arc to be the weakest. Yeah. And I thought, oh, Tyrion's over there. I'm going to be interested in this bit now. But then they just put Tyrion in a boring storyline, as far as I'm concerned.
This is the thing. She rises to power, then loses power, and then rises to power again, and she loses power. And wait a minute, oh wait, she's back with the Dothraki now. And
yeah.
It's sort of like, and then it was sort of like they made this whole thing about her being fireproof. I'm thinking, well, we established this back in season one that she's fireproof. So as soon as we saw her basically setting that up, everyone was like, oh, it was this incredible ending. I didn't see that coming. I was like, how did you not see that coming? You know she's fireproof. These other people obviously aren't fireproof.
People need to stop being around her and fire. If you're in the same room as Dany and fire, leave the room.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a dragon there, it's not going to end well for you.
Yeah.
You can't control a dragon. She can. These are the rules that no one ever seems to grasp hold of. So, I don't know. I've yet to have that big Game of Thrones moment. We've not had moments like the Sand Snakes, like the daughters we had in the previous season, who were busy going around poisoning everyone, which I thought was absolutely great.
Do you reckon we're going to go back to Dawn at some? Or do you think we're going to go back to Dawn at some point ever?
I hope so. It's one of my favorite territories. That's in the Ironborn who finally decided to do something now after goodness how many seasons. Cause,
let's do something. We're in contract, but not making any money. But so.
Oh, when Game of Thrones first came out, the Sky Atlantic were like, oh, which house do you belong to? And you could belong to
Hufflepuff.
So Ironborn. And it's sort of like, they made this big deal of them being this major family, and obviously now they finally decide to do something, so.
Yeah, they were like one of the four or five main families.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when Ian McShane was announced as being cast in the show at some point, I thought, he's going to be Euron Greyjoy. That's going to be awesome. And because I feel like he would be absolutely perfect casting. And I'm a little disappointed that they've cast somebody else. Especially I've got a feeling for the character that McShane's going to be playing, and it's not enough for my Ian McShane fix.
Yeah. I was kind of holding out for Mads Mikkelsen.
That's a very different character than Ian McShane, but yes, that would be amazing. Yeah, I can see
it's
that.
It's still 10 out.
But yeah, we're about halfway through the season, and we haven't had Ian McShane yet, and I'm really looking forward to Ian McShane.
Well, I think that they have too many characters at this point. Like, where is Bronn? I love Bronn. I want Bronn to come back and do something, but I think they just run out of stuff for him to do.
I think Bronn's on his own island at the moment. I think last time we saw him, he was a duke.
I want to see bloody Jerome on his own island. Kicking it back with his lady. You know. Bronn's great. I miss Bronn.
Okay. Do you have anything else that we want to discuss about Game of Thrones?
No, there's only two more seasons after this, I think.
Yeah.
Like one and a half.
They want to... Benioff and Weiss want to wrap it up after season, I guess, eight.
I think it's about right. Where we are now and my current feelings on the series, I feel that it's got enough juice in the tank to get to seven. I don't feel it's going to be one of these series that's going to burn out. I think that it's going to take us till seven just to wrap up where all these characters are. It's that vast, the cast of characters and plots at the moment. So I think it's going to take us till season seven just to basically get everything in. But do we want to make any prediction who ends up on the Iron Throne at the end?
Sir Pounce.
No. It won't be, but I'd like it to be Littlefinger. He's a character that I do enjoy, and I was glad to see him return in this episode, but it won't be him. He will at some point die. But I'd like it to be him. No, I'm going with the fan theory that the three-headed dragon is Tyrion, Dany, and Jon.
Yeah.
And something will happen between those three, and Sansa will end up running the whole thing. No, Tormund and Brienne. King and Queen
Tormund
of Westeros.
Tormund and Brienne, there you go.
King and Queen of Westeros, there we go. Done.
I'm all for that.
Okay, I mean, obviously, Game of Thrones has been holding everyone's attention, but for myself, it pales into comparison to a show we've mentioned maybe one or twice on the show, and perhaps in briefly passing, and that's Gotham, which continues to be phenomenal. It's just ended in the States. This second series, it felt like we've had three seasons worth of material thrown into one series, and so far they've only made one misstep, in my opinion, and that's in the creation of Mr. Freeze. Whereas when he's first introduced as Victor Freeze, he's got a similar outfit to Captain Cold in The Flash. But when he becomes Mr. Freeze, he becomes suddenly a bleached version of Jim Jarmusch. Which is, again, it's one minor misstep in this fantastic season. We've seen BD Wong come back. I know some of you there today to be excited about.
I am a fan of BD Wong. But no matter how much you rave about this show, you've yet to convince me to watch a single second of it.
Okay, BD Wong shows up as the Asian version of Doctor Strange.
Okay.
Or Hugo Strange. And the show itself, it's, for those not familiar with it, it's a Sin City-esque version of Batman in a way, with the young Jim Gordon basically trying to bring law and order to the city of Gotham. And as we also see the early beginnings of the various Batman villains, as well as young Bruce Wayne, basically taking his formative steps towards becoming Batman. I know there's people out there who bashed on the first season. The second season has really been absolutely phenomenal. I'm going to continue just promoting the hell out of it, because I've absolutely loved it, and I'm looking forward to season three. Other exciting news for releases, we saw the return of both Banshee and Silicon Valley this week. I don't know, do either of you guys watch Banshee at all?
No, but I am working my way through season two of Silicon Valley.
Okay.
I have only recently heard of Banshee, which is, I guess, kind of surprising considering it's apparently been going on for a while.
Yeah, we're on our final season now, Banshee, sadly. Basically, it's about this ex-con named Lucas Hood. He's a thief who's hiding out in the town of Banshee. It's an Amish town, and he basically assumes the role of the dead sheriff. And basically, he's the badass who does bad things to bad people. This show, again, is very gritty, it's bloody, it's violent, and it's absolutely great for the grime content. It's only one of the final season now. It's only had four seasons, but it's a show definitely worth checking out. Silicon Valley. Jay, you said already you're a fan.
Yeah, I'm going through season two, so I kind of caught it really late. I think I saw an episode on a plane and liked it, and so I went back and watched the rest of it. Yeah, I like the characters. It's not as funny as I thought it would be in terms of like jokes per minute. It's more kind of slow build or like background humor.
Yeah.
But I enjoy it all the same, and I like pretty much all of the main guys. The one I'd not seen anything he's in before, the guy who plays Jared. Can't remember his name, but he's my favorite. I like his character because he's the epitome of uncoolness, and I can relate to that. So
that's cool. Yeah, I mean, I love Silicon Valley. Like, are you a fan of Silicon Valley?
I have not had a chance to see it yet.
That's very surprising. I would have thought this would have been really up your sort of street.
It's an HBO or a Showtime show, right?
Okay.
It's not, yeah, and I don't have premium cable over here. And actually, really, the only reason I actually watch Game of Thrones is because I have a friend with an HBO subscription, and we go over to his place on Thursdays and watch it. But it's just, it takes these episodes for these shows a long time to get to streaming. And so, like, a lot of these premium shows, other than Game of Thrones, like Homeland, which runs on Showtime, I was really hyped for the first couple seasons of Homeland, and then I fell behind, and I don't have the network, and I'm not going to pay like $15 a month for it.
Yeah.
Just for the one show. I have heard a lot of good things about Silicon Valley. I'm looking forward to checking it out eventually. I just don't know when it's going to be.
Yeah, it's surprising that a show from the creator of Beavis and Butthead and King the Hill could be so smart. I mean, my judge is a really sort of switched on guy. Anyone who's seen interviews with him or knows his past, he was an aerial engineer.
Right.
Before he obviously went into doing animation. And obviously did Beavis and Butthead, been his standout thing, and then he did King the Hill. But it's so surprisingly smart, and it really taps into that same area as Betas tried to do, or Microsurfs, which I believe that, sorry, JPod.
JPod, yeah.
Which you liked, but again, I can't get into. It's
Douglas Copeland.
Yeah, it's basically just these nerdy guys working in the valley, basically trying to develop this groundbreaking program, while at the same time facing competition from all these rival companies are basically trying to rip them off. And about while they essentially just Forrest Gump their way through each episode. It's
Is it like a period show? Does it take place, or does it take place in the modern day?
Modern day.
Modern day. Because
it's the one that I'm drawing the parallels to, which is a period show and it's a drama, is Halt and Catch Fire, which is a series that is, I don't know why I'm not watching that either. But that's a show that takes place in like the early 80s and is about like the, it's a fictional, a very thinly fictionalized version of the race to build the IBM PC.
It's, if you've not seen Silicon Valley, it's certainly one of those shows that's definitely worth checking out when you can. You can get the first two seasons on box set at the moment, and
it's just fun. You know,
it's a very easy show to sit down and binge, I find.
Yeah, it's not one to take too seriously. You just kind of want to have on and enjoy it.
Yeah. I think my favorite moment they've had so far is when they're trying to work out the compression rate of this program by comparing it to the amount to jerking off every guy in the room.
Yeah.
The amount of guys that they can jerk off at one time.
Yeah, that's, I saw that clip before ever watching the show, and that's one of the reasons that I kind of started watching it. It's easily the highlight of the first season. It's just right at the end of the last episode of it. It's just, yeah, they just start that off on a really offhand comment, and then it just goes on for the entire night of them working out the best way of doing this.
It's a lot. Keep a good sleep, Ben. Your source for masturbation jokes.
It's wonderful. It really is. Just, you know, would like girth have an effect? And just see all the guys in the room miming, jacking off two guys at once and changing the girth size and thinking, yeah, it would. That's comedy.
You've also got one of my favorite characters in this is a Satanist who's on their he's on their program. I can't remember his name now.
Oh, it's Martin Starr playing him.
Martin Starr, Guilfoyle.
That's the one.
And they have this episode where they go to Saints in this meeting because one of the heads of Yahoo has decided to take the left-handed path. And they're like, they go to the Saints in this meeting and they're talking about Violet in their parking and putting on a nice spread for them. Well, this supposed head of Yahoo sitting there bollock naked. It's, as I said, I just really can't recommend this enough. Just go watch it. Take our recommendation for it. You've got myself and Jay. There's two people there recommending the show.
Yeah.
It's good. Definitely check it out. My last sort of standout recommendation over on Crunchyroll is the series Girls on Panzer, which is an anime series. It's in an alternate timeline where schools teach tankery as an elective class. Then they hold competitions in these old girls' schools where they hold sort of mock tank battles with each other, which instead of blowing each other up, they fire these shells which can read when a tank's been hit and they shoot up these flags. So they engage in mock tank battles. It's a fantastically funny show, and the fact that you've got all these different social groups who all have their own sort of tanks. So you've got like the hole monitors, you've got the volleyball team, you've got the history nerds who all dress up as different tank commanders throughout history. You've got one dressed as Paladin. It's a wonderfully random show, and again, it's only about 12 episodes long, so it's a fun one to knock out over on Crunchyroll, and especially if you've been looking for an entry point to get into some anime and not wanting to take on something that's 148 episodes long. Girls on Panzer is a great little starting point. Lackey, I mean, have you got anything else that you wanted to watch? Yeah, you got anything?
My TV season is winding down. Better Call Saul is done for the year. I think I mentioned, I don't know whether that had finished by the last time I did the last episode. We had several finales this week. The only one I can remember is called The Midwife. But the one that's kind of on its closing stretch for the year, this has been an absolutely sterling season for the Americans. And have either of you watched The Americans?
Nope.
No, but I remember you recommending it to me, and it's on the list to watch because I know it's on Amazon Prime at the moment. So eventually,
yeah,
I will get around to watching it, much like Better Call Saul. I will actually get around to watching it.
Yeah, Better Call Saul had a bit of a slow start this season, but really the last three or four episodes were absolutely top notch. But The Americans has been just knocking it out of the park this year. Some absolutely great writing, great performances from the cast. Dylan Baker has joined as a gruff, cynical Dylan Baker character that he plays in everything he ever does. He's wonderful to watch in here. The other show that I really, really have liked where it's gone this year, and I never thought I'd say this because I thought there was no way in hell this show could be good when I started watching this, Bates Motel. Next year is most likely going to be the final year. Carlton Cuse, I think, has said it's going to be like a 5-season story. So this was just the end of season 4. And there has just been some brilliant, brilliant stuff going on here. I can't recommend the cast on the show. Has really been amazing. Freddie Highmore, Vera Farmiga, Nestor Carbonell, obviously. And Ryan Hurst, Opie from Sons of Anarchy, has had a recurring role as an eccentric drug dealer. He was introduced last season as a neighbor of Caleb and Dylan, and he is just you can really, Carlton Cuse has always said that Twin Peaks has been a prime influence on Bates Motel, and you can just see that in the character of Chick. But Better Call Saul, those are the shows I'm really, really hyping this year. Like I said, but this has really been very, very easily the best seasons of Bates Motel and The Americans so far. The Americans has been renewed for its final 2 seasons, so it's going to go to season 6. So it's Weisberg, and I can't remember, Joel Fields and Joe Weisberg They're getting a chance to, and you can kind of see them moving the pieces into play for the end game on this one. But it has just been, to go back to the Americans, it has just been an emotional run of episodes here. I cannot recommend the show more highly.
I've yet to watch Bates Motel. I think because it's on Universal over here in the UK, and unless it's Law and Order, it kind of gives me like a question mark over a series if it shows up on Universal first, the same as if it shows up on Watch instead of like the main channel, like Atlantic or Sky One. It's sort of like, okay, wasn't good enough for them to pick it up. Does this mean it's only going to have one season, or does it not mean that it's of a less quality? So I've not watched Bates Motel. I think I only know one other person who's been watching, that's Christine over at the Feminine Critique, and she's said positive things about it, like yourself. But
I actually ended up skipping the first season because I just felt it had potential in the first season, but I felt it really just hadn't. It took for me a long time to get its groove. It really didn't start to really grab me until early last season. But here it has just been, they have been knocking it out of the park, or I guess to whatever the cricket equivalent of knocking it out of the park is.
He's pretty much still knocking it out of the park.
Okay.
Knocked it for six.
It knocked it for six. I mean, they're really, you know, it's I'm loving the hell out of it. And there have really, there was a big shock in the penultimate episode of this season that I will not spoil, but really something I knew was coming, but I was just like, ooh, they're doing it now. And it's just, love it.
We got anything else that's still been holding our attention, guys? Is that it?
I liked the first episode of Angie Tribeca, but I haven't watched the rest of it yet.
I've still got to watch it. I will eventually get around to it.
And I'm still going through Parks and Rec. I'm up to season 5, I think. And Brooklyn Nine-Nine is still good. I'm just waiting for the Great British Bake Off to come back.
Yes. I'm still waiting for we recently had a documentary, The Life of Human Pups, here in the UK. If you are in the UK and missed it, you can catch it on All4s. Show about guys who like to dress up in PVC dog costumes and act like dogs. Apparently women don't like it. They like to do kid and play instead, which seems to be hinting at the sequel to this, The Secret Life of Human Cats, I guess. So, I mean, Jay, did you watch it? I know everyone.
I did not, and after the description, I will not. It doesn't sound like something I'm going to enjoy. It sounds like something I'll sit and roll my eyes through the entirety of it.
So,
I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's my little slice of randomness for you this episode. Obviously, brings us to the end of another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. Obviously, I'd like to thank our special guest this evening, Jay Clitt, for obviously joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If people want to come and find you on the Tinterweb, where's the best place to find you?
Well, everything I write gets linked to from lifeversusfilm.com. That's lifevsfilm.com. And there's also, you know, the lamb site, largeassmovieblogs.com. That's ass is actually ass, largeassmovieblogs.com. Because it was created by an American, dammit. Or find me on Twitter either at LifeVSFilm, at Lambcast for the podcast, or at Lamb for the Lamb.
Cool. And obviously, next episode, it's like, what have we got coming up?
Well, here he comes, here comes Speed Racer. We're going to be covering the opening two-parter of what is probably the only anime that most people who aren't nerds have heard of, unless you got a kid who's really into Naruto or Pokemon or something like that. It's going to be the opening episodes of Speed Racer from 1967. It's a two-parter. I'm reminding myself of the title of the episodes here, variously referred to as The Great Plan or Dash Mach 5.
Cool.
Apparently, they really like to put exclamation points in their episode titles in Japan. I noticed a lot of that in like Ultra Q and stuff like that.
Yeah. For myself, we're going to be looking at a new web series called Jess Archer. This expands upon the original short, Jess Archer versus the X. If you're not familiar with this, Jess Archer is essentially a combination of Veronica Mars meets Scott Pilgrim. So very excited about this. They've just recently, as of this episode coming out, so every Monday they are going to be releasing a new episode of this web series. So we're going to be looking at both Jess Archer versus the X, the original short, as well as the first episode of this new web series. So very excited to see that, and obviously to look at some Speed Racer, which is always cool to see some old school anime. But if people want to obviously find us, like it was, the best place to find us.
The best place to find us is, well, the best place to find me is at thenightmaregallery.com, which I will be returning to as soon as my life stops getting in the way of what's really important, which is watching thrillers and writing about them. And you can also find me, I'm sure we have a website somewhere. I just always forget where it is.
Yeah.
If you head to the internet, he's there somewhere.
Yes.
Obviously, if you want to get in touch with the show, we are on Twitter, which is at TV Good Sleep Bad. We are on Facebook as well. Just type in TV Good Sleep Bad. It will come up there as well. Please let us know your feedback. Either let us know in the comment section below or leave us a nice little rating on iTunes, whatever works for you. Obviously, full links, of course, are in the description section below. And as for myself, I will, as always, I'm still at from the DVD depths of DVD hell, which is still business as usual. You can follow me on Twitter, which is at Elwood_Jones. And recently, I've just recently launched a video game podcast called Game Warp, which, again, you can find on YouTube now. Just type in Game Warp. We also have a Twitter feed up there, which is at Game Warp Podcast, and the Facebook page is up there as well. Again, all links can be found at the bottom. And
you just want to rival Bubba Wheat's media empire, don't you?
This is the thing. I just keep making these bloody things. It's sort of like it's like, oh, I got 5 minutes of my 5 minutes of free time. What should I do? I know. I'll launch another show because editing is just what I love to do.
I've got like 3 podcasts I want to start, but I just there is no way. There is no way.
Yeah, I've actually teamed up with Kim over at Tranquil Dreams for this show. And we've just launched our first show where we looked at Unravel. Our show that's coming up, we're going to be looking at Life is Strange. And this is all, of course, tied into the ThatMomentIn.com network, where I'm also writing some retro video game reviews as well. And just, you know, cleansing the palate from just looking at bizarre and obscure movies, so... It's a lot of fun, but definitely check them out as well, thatmovie.com.
Yep, they're at That Moment In, Member of the Lamb.
Are they? This is the thing. I can never tell whether who's a Lamb member or not.
Just ask me. I'll let you know. I have the list.
And just while we're obviously saying thanks again, as always, to the Ven at the Ven's Video Vortex for providing that intro, as well as Fuzzy Machete for providing that wonderful intro music as well. But until next time, this is Edward Jones saying goodbye. Thank you again to my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hello. Oh, sorry. Goodbye.
And, of course, thank you again to our special co-host, Jay.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.